You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of February 2017 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., whose incredible example is unique in American history. You read all about Dr. Martin Luther King a week ago when somebody said, I took the statue out of my office. And it turned out that that was fake news. So I think it was a disgrace, but that's the way the press is.
There are those hidebound, out-of-touch establishment politicians who'd say that launching Black History Month is no time or place to whinge about your press coverage. It's all change in the brave new world of President Donald Trump. My guests Daniela Peled and Shashank Joshi will be here to discuss Trump's ongoing war with the media and the day's other big stories, including the obstinate popularity of populism, the wisdom of picking an avoidable fight over where one situates one's embassy, and how valuable is justice to the long deceased. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to the show. My guests today are Daniela Peled, Managing Editor at the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, and Shashank Joshi, Senior Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both. And we will start tonight with the United States and what seems likely to become a vexingly recurrent dynamic for the next 4 years. President Donald Trump's executive order imposing a 90-day travel ban on citizens of 7 mostly Muslim countries and halting refugees altogether for 120 days outraged liberal opinion around the world, but according to recent polling, played pretty well at home. A Reuters Ipsos poll found 48% of Americans strongly or somewhat in favour and 41% strongly or somewhat against. Daniela, do those numbers surprise you?
They surprise me a little that there should be so many people supporting it. To be, you know, slightly go easier on the people who do. You know, some people might have, there is a basis, they would say, for restricted immigration from these countries, that you could make the case for it on paper.
It is a vague question.
Yeah, it's a vague question. And I think one of the other questions were, do you feel safer? Do you feel more safe because of this ban, or do you feel less safe because of this ban? Which also, I think the questioning seemed a bit off to me. But then again, in this era of, we have to say this several times in each show, fake news, alternative truths and so on, but also very self-selecting media consumption, I can imagine that what your experience through the media and through social media of the effects of this ban is very, very different. I mean, I know lots of people who've been directly affected, lots of people who are sharing their experiences, nationals from this, from the affected country. So for me, the human impact, the human short-term impact, let alone the diplomatic or strategic effects, has been very real. Whereas if you exist in a sort of smaller news bubble, then if you take it on face value, you think, well, okay, what's the problem with this?
Shashank, as Daniela mentions, there was also the question of whether people felt more or less safe because of this ban. 31% said they felt more safe, 26% less safe, which I guess is fairly interesting in itself. But why is it, do you think, that so many people still vastly statistically overrate the danger of terrorism, which is not to belittle the suffering of people who have suffered because of it, but the facts are what the facts are. If you live in the United States, statistically, you have vastly more chance of being crushed to death by a vending machine, struck by lightning, and certainly more chance of being caught in crossfire at the shopping mall than you do of being a victim of Islamist terrorism.
And to that we could add being killed by cows and drowning in the bathtub, both of which are statistics I know show bigger risks than terrorism. But of course, we understand that terrorism is uniquely emotive, it's particularly shocking, it dominates a news agenda, and above all, it's political. You know, of course it's not equivalent to these acts, because more than any of those things, it's deeply, deeply political and random, and that really scares us. But what I would say is that there are different aspects to this ban, some of which are more egregious than others. On refugees, for example, I was very interested to see, looking back historically, only 3 refugees since 1975 have committed successful acts acts of terrorism on American soil. And of course, predictably, all three are Cuban, committing, you know, effectively political terrorism, no Islamist terrorism at all. But if you look at the news and you read, as you say, Fox News or Breitbart or whatever else, you're hearing stories about hordes of sex-crazed Muslim men in Germany or in other parts of Europe, and you were foreseeing that in America. That's a vision you have, which is why it looms so large. The European example dominates American thinking more than any of the other sort of day-to-day depravities like cows and bathtubs that we could have talked about.
Daniela, there were, of course, protests not just in the United States but all across the world this week following this executive order by Trump. How do those people who joined those demonstrations and those sympathetic to them deal with the fact, as we look ahead to the next 4 years, that a lot of Trump's measures are going to be quite popular with quite a lot of people? How does one go about, winning that 48% over?
Well, that's very difficult. I think it's important to remember we're less than 2 weeks in.
You know, God, it seems like 20 years already.
It seems like a long time. There's already been enormous marches, enormous rallies. And although I'm generally not such a fan of these things, they seem rather self-indulgent and not necessarily in a good way. I think in this case, it's very important for there to be a sense of solidarity between people around the world who oppose these policies. And people want to and need to mobilise. One of the biggest dangers, I think, is that people will just be burnt out very quickly, because there's a lot of appetite to go to marches and make your voice heard, so on and so forth. At the moment, it's easy to click an online petition and so on and so forth. But in terms of sustained protests, especially because people are not used to seeing American people are very anti-imperialist, but it's a bit of an effete, student-style pose. People are not used to seeing America as an actual danger to democracy and to their own democracy. I think that we're not going to be able to rely too much on people power. I think legal challenges and international alliances are going to play a larger part.
It's also just becoming more comfortable for the left with the idea of a more rough adversarial politics. Let's face it, you know, 8 years ago when Obama came to prominence with his speech at the convention about there not being red states and blue states and the language of unity, it's proved to be bunk. None of it worked. A Congress consistently sought to frustrate his agenda for 8 years. That's over. It's done. And I think the left has to get used to it and realise there are vast amounts of Americans who believe horrific things, and whilst we can and should address the economic circumstances that may contribute to that, we have to fight against the culture in the culture wars, which Trump is resuscitating and prosecuting.
Well, on a related note, we should look now at what seems likely to be another recurring motif of Trump's presidency, his vendetta against the media, with all its impudent insistence on testing his outbursts against verifiable reality. As recently as today, he spent much of what was supposed to be an address to a Black History Month event whining about his press notices. This occurred against a backdrop of two other intriguing stories. One of a policy of freezing out CNN, another of an intent to offer White House credentials to InfoWars, the perfervid conspirazoid outlet beloved of the tinfoil hat tendency. Daniela, we need to address this first by noting that there is no yet official confirmation that InfoWars will be credentialed. InfoWars are claiming that this is in the bag, but measured against many of the other things that InfoWars have claimed, we should possibly hold off on that one a bit. But I'll put to you the standard question, which is becoming the standard question already about the Donald Trump presidency. Do we perceive anywhere in this a sinister master plan at work, or is this just trousers on fire chaos?
Well, it's very hard to tell, isn't it? I've read innumerable pieces saying, actually, this is all part of the Steve Bannon master plan.
I have read those pieces as
indeed, well. Indeed. And all sorts of like amusing cartoons with him behind the wheels of power. And I think that the situation is such an enormous, enormous mess that our rational brains are searching very hard to try and find some rationale behind it. It may well be just pants on fire. It may well be that giving the chief pant firers too much too much credit. Again, I repeat, we're less than 2 weeks into this. If it's a sinister master plan, it's working very well and very, very fast.
I look forward to day one of InfoWars in the briefing room. Question one, Mr. President, do you believe that jet fuel does in fact melt steel beams or not? But actually, I think...
Will you let us into Area 51?
I mean, where is it?
The possibilities are endless, aren't they?
But of course, I think InfoWars is a distraction. Of course, it's loony, and the fact we're talking about it is disturbing and echoes this contempt for truth. But there is something important here, which is the presidency's willingness to use alternative channels of information and media. And some of them are not outrageous. You know, for example, he's been talking to the Christian News Network, and that's where he propounded at length this idea that Christians weren't being let into the United States, they were being slaughtered, which, of course, you know, this was clearly the animating spirit of the Muslim ban. It wasn't in the executive order. It wasn't in his remarks to the New York Times. It was in his interview, verbal interview to the Christian News Network. And they are speaking to these third-party, small, minor outlets, some of which have better journalistic standards than others. And actually, one idea, and this is the first thing I've said where I actually respect one of the ideas. They want to give two seats in the press briefing room to Skype seats, to outlets that are not physically present in Washington, to allow them to ask questions. Now, they will, of course, give them to complete nutters. But the idea, the idea of having this broader channel of information, you know, I don't think that's such a bad idea. And it does reflect something powerful.
On the credit where it's due front, I think that is theoretically a good idea, depending on, you know, who they Skype exactly. Daniela, this is me possibly attempting to be overly optimistic. Is there a danger to Trump himself if he overdoes the apportioning of his media outreach to what we'll charitably describe as alternative outlets?
Well, I don't think so. He's done very well going exactly down that, to us, counterintuitive route so far. The mainstream media has never been more despised, it would seem, although my respect for it grows anew the whole time. I think that we also need, I speak for myself, as journalists, we also need to be very careful and take responsibility now. As I said earlier, we're used to treating the office of the President of the United States with perhaps scepticism and cynicism, but with respect and with the assumption that this person has an idea, that he might be wrong, but he has an idea, that he knows what he's doing. And Reuters put out a very interesting briefing this week saying, how are they going to handle this new reality? And they're saying that they need to use the same techniques that they do when reporting on more repressive regimes across Central Asia, South and Central America, and be less reliant on government statements and government sources and official access. Because in this context, it means a lot less. You can still cover the news, you can still cover government affairs, even if, as they're doing to CNN, you're being frozen out of official briefings and official talking points.
Shashank, is there anything that grown-up media can do to address the fact that so many people clearly, now that they have the opportunity to ignore it, because, you know, there are so many channels available, I think there has been a tendency for all of the human experiment for people to believe what they want to believe, but now it's easier for them to reinforce that than it ever has been. So is there anything the media can do to reach people who are determined to believe, as InfoWars, for example, does, that the Sandy Hook massacre was a hoax and so were the moon landings and so was September 11th and so was basically whatever you're having yourself? Or does the media just have to assume that, you know, large parts of the electorate are beyond its reach now?
Do you know, I'm really pessimistic on that question. I really struggle to think what they can do. I know MPs have been debating fake news this week and Sandy Hook truthers are a form of fake news, and I think that's not the way to go, government involvement in vetting these things. But good, solid reporting at length, which is contextualized, well-sourced, is actually can be a little bit boring compared to the bright, flashing headlines of Breitbart and the emotive ethno-nationalist calls to action spurring people on. It is a little bit boring in comparison, apart from to people like us who are ultimately all political wonks to one degree or another. I'm really pessimistic. I mean, but Daniela, do you have any ideas on this?
I'm generally pessimistic too, a little less pessimistic on this, because I think ordinary people who are not wonks, as you so charmingly put it, people don't like being lied to and they don't like the feeling that they're being lied to. And I think this holding of rigorous fact-checking has been has been a good thing. The whole fact checking.
It hasn't worked. We've been doing it for years. I've been watching the Post and others do this and have, you know, what's the newspaper that gives out Pinocchios for the number of lies a politician tells? We've been doing this for years, and I feel like it doesn't have any impact on what happens or how people assess it.
I don't think it has been quite this shameless for a very long time. Now, we're talking endlessly, as I said, about alternative facts, about post-truth. I think still people feel, they feel the mainstream media is lying to them. People have always felt that politicians are lying to them. But there is a level to which people cannot tolerate.
They voted for a man who spent years, who kicked his career arguing the president was a Kenyan-born Muslim. We all fact-checked that. That was fact-checked into oblivion. It didn't stop 60 million people voting for him.
No, it's true. It's true. I think people are willing to ignore these wider lies and wider fudgings because they, I think, possibly partly they want to punish, it's a vote against, they wanted to punish people. They wanted to punish the elites. They voted for the outsider. But then again, it becomes much more personal. If the president is lying to you, then that means something. I mean, you might be right. Maybe this is totally unearned optimism from me.
Daniela, though, you were saying that your respect for the media had been reinvigorated somewhat in the last, God, has it really only been 13 days? It has, hasn't it? 12. Not mm-hmm. even 13.
Not even 13.
So that's, what, 1,440-something still to go? Have you been impressed by the way that the media has responded to the bizarreness of the last 12 days?
Well, I've certainly been more impressed in the way the political class has responded. I haven't been particularly enamoured of the way our Prime Minister, Theresa May, leapt across the Atlantic to meet Donald Trump, held hands and all the rest of it. I think there has been some very good journalism, and not grandstanding, but sort of humble fact-checking, which I think will chip away. That the guy who was tasked to investigate the whole fake voting shenanigans, who was actually registered to vote in three
states,
different...
Yeah,
yes, I mean, that kind of thing. Like, let's keep on keeping on that. I think that's pretty good. And that's old-fashioned journalism.
Do you know what I've been really pleased with, though? It's the mainstream right-wing conservative columnists really making some strong cases.
There's been a lot of that, yeah.
David Brooks with a very powerful case yesterday. Elliot Cohen, the neoconservative scholar. That's where a lot of this, I think, will come from, the mainstream right.
Absolutely.
Well, on that semi-hopeful note, we will take a short break. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Daniela Pellet and Shashank Joshi. Coming up next, Donald Trump. I nearly called him the Trump. Donald Trump, the US Embassy in Israel, was what I meant to say, and Jerusalem. Will he or won't he?
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing Bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Istanbul, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The Entrepreneurs is Monocle's weekly tour of the best companies, cleverest minds, and most visionary ideas in global business.
Genius is that little spark that makes us different from anybody that ever lived and anybody that ever will live.
From fashion to food, timepieces to tech, we shine light on the movers and shakers shaping the future of industry and commerce.
How do we continue to let companies grow, to enhance research, but at the same time, make good decisions, make ethical decisions when we are in this world of uncertainty?
Tune in to hear how some of the smartest names in business got their start, where they went wrong, and how they turned it all around.
My goal was to brew the best ever Indian beer. Never sold a bottle of beer in my life, but that was my mission.
That's The Entrepreneurs, every Wednesday at 1900 hours London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Daniela Pellid and Shashank Joshi. Now, there are very few perennial diplomatic clamours quite so tedious as the one urging the United States and other countries, but mostly the United States, to uproot their embassies in Israel from Tel Aviv and relocate them to Jerusalem, thereby legitimising the latter as Israel's eternal and indivisible capital. President Trump has pronounced favourably on the idea, but would he do it? And perhaps more to the point, can he? Daniela, why is this such a priority? Well, maybe not for Israel, but certainly for Benjamin Netanyahu.
Well, it's all about massive symbols. To Israelis, Jerusalem is, as you said, the eternal, undivided capital, whereas to the Palestinians and most of the rest of the world, its status is to be decided still in final status negotiations, because the Palestinians would like to have East Jerusalem as their capital city too.
Shashank, how actually possible is this? The example that keeps leaping to my mind was, I remember visiting the US Embassy in Beirut in late 2001. So this would have been the third US Embassy in Beirut after the misfortunes that befell the first two. And they'd relocated to a hillside outside the city. I think they'd bought pretty much every building within two block radius and bulldozed them so nothing could get near the building. You had to get in and out of three cars in a 10-yard space to get in and out of the compound, and the security guards disassembled my biro. Now, what kind of security nightmare would a US embassy in Jerusalem be?
I mean, it depends where it is, but of course, it would be enormously risky. And particularly for Trump, having built his last year of his career on attacking Hillary Clinton for insufficient diplomatic security at a key site, I think it's something he would pay attention to. But in terms of putting that aside, which is ultimately a manageable risk. We have embassies, American embassies, in very, very high-risk places, probably more so than Jerusalem. Putting that one aside, what about the politics of it? He is willing to take a step like this. He is willing to take bold, reckless, far-reaching moves that other people would think are simply unfeasible. And of course, his ambassador to Israel, his prospective ambassador, I think he has to get confirmed, is a hardline pro-settlement individual. In a way, I think he seems to have rode back after his conversation with Netanyahu. And of course, that indicates this classic thing, as with the Iran deal and other areas. Israel talks very loudly on certain key issues, but when you talk in private or more quietly, do they actually want that? Or do they recognize some of the diplomatic fallout that may result from moving the embassy? I think he's possibly rode back a little bit. Some of it may, of course, also be to do with his desire to maintain good relations with the Arab states, who ultimately he wants to pay for his safe zones in Syria, should they ever turn up.
Daniela, there's some reasonably well-sourced reports that King Abdullah of Jordan was briefing US officials that Israeli intelligence sources were absolutely mortified by the idea. Does that sound plausible?
Yeah, it sounds very plausible. It sounds very plausible because in terms of political gain from this, well, it's a great, I mean, I think most Israelis would support the idea of the American embassy being in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is Israel's capital, although the international community recognises its sovereignty over the western part of the city. Mm-hmm. So domestically, it would be very popular. But
the US does not, the US doesn't take a position on what the formal capital is. Is that correct?
Well, they recognise that Israel's sovereign in West Jerusalem.
Yeah, correct, but not that Israel. It's not that it's recognised as the capital.
Yeah, I mean,
they don't say Tel Aviv is either. They just don't.
No,
say
there is already a US consulate general in Jerusalem.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, but they. I mean, it's been a presidential waiver every 6 months for 20 or 30 years to not move the embassy to Jerusalem, and there has also been talk of some compromise solutions. For instance, the ambassador would live in Jerusalem. and then commute to Tel Aviv, perhaps vice versa. I think...
Isn't that the status quo? He lives at Tel Aviv and commutes to Jerusalem.
No. No, I think he lives in Ramat Gan, actually, which is like sort of suburbia. The point is that people would... There would be enough to satisfy...
Right.
Satisfy public opinion, satisfy opinion. But if the move actually happened, there would inevitably be an upsurge in violence, and not just in Israel and the Palestinian territories, but regionally. There'd be an awful lot of bloodshed and lives lost. And needlessly, it's not enough of a gain. It's not enough of a diplomatic win to make it worthwhile, really.
And what makes it even more explosive this year is the anniversary of the Six-Day War. And that's problematic not just because it's a sensitive time, it's an emotionally heightened time, but also, of course, that's the point at which Israel secures full control of Jerusalem. And moving the embassy in a way that coincides with the anniversary of the Six-Day War, maybe inadvertently to reinforce the idea of full Israel sovereignty over all of Jerusalem. And of people like Dan Shapiro, the outgoing ambassador, have said, look, moving it's not necessarily catastrophic, but if you do it in a sensitive way, but one of that sensitivities has to be you cannot, in doing so, endorse Israel's claim to all of Jerusalem, because by that, you really blow up processes around the two-state solution.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we will close with one from the Better Late Than Never file. The British government has passed a law effectively posthumously pardoning tens of thousands of gay and bisexual men for breaking now abolished laws which criminalised homosexuality. It has become informally known as Turing's Law, in honour of Alan Turing, the genius codebreaker who, having helped win World War II for civilisation, was hounded to suicide for his troubles. Shashank, Turing received a royal pardon in 2013. Why did that take so long, and why has this taken so long?
Well, I think part of it is my understanding that there was legal issues around how you repudiate a law, because I think the same legislation that was used to hound people like Turing and many other gay men, I think was also used for wider offences beyond just those for sort of homosexual acts or suspected homosexual acts. So they were very careful. They didn't, in effect, want to pardon people who were not in the same category as Turing and others like that. But I think part of it is there's also a large school of thought amongst, you know, the much of the right in Britain that you don't apologise for things in history. You don't engage in historical apologia. It's like the black armband school of history. We don't do that sort of thing. We're proud of our past and we're not going to be sorry about it. And I think that's probably also held up a sense of contrition for this.
Daniela, what value is there in a gesture like this? Most of the people directly affected, many of whom were imprisoned, you know, are now dead. This law, by the way, also it cleans Oscar Wilde's slate, among many others. So clearly it's of no value to the dead. What good does it do the rest of us?
Well, I always thought it was rather eccentric, these cases where people fight to clear their loved ones' names after they died. They're wrongly accused, wrongly executed. First World War.
The desertion cases, yeah.
Yeah, I always thought it was a little bit strange. In this case, I think it makes a lot more sense, because we're talking about things that happened within living memory. I remember the 1980s, how scandalous it would be if a Tory minister was found to have homosexual tendencies and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And now they were described as tendencies.
Exactly. Or people, they were described as openly gay. You know?
Flaunting it.
And so really, I think gay rights has been one of the most successful civil liberties movements in recent times. And there's been such great movement for this. I think this is, symbols are also important.
It took a Labour government. It was, I think, Gordon Brown, 07, who really made that far-reaching statement on Alan Turing. And that statement was very, very important, because it was applied to Turing, but actually it made very clear that this was an act that was meant to apply more broadly. So this is a natural continuation of that.
Yeah, and although I'm not such a great fan of David Cameron, he did make the absolute strategic move to say that it was completely acceptable for ministers and politicians to be gay, and he was seemed to be a strong supporter of
Theresa
that.
Theresa May has a more sorry voting record on that, if you go back to her time in the 90s, and she reflected the prejudices and bigotry of the Conservative Party at the time.
I think he did it in a tactical way to make the Conservatives seem like less of a nasty party, but whatever, it worked. It's now part of our political and our social landscape. So I think this is quite a nice. I think this is quite a nice move.
Shashank, there's a long answer to this, and you've got about 20 seconds. As Daniela points out, this has happened very fast. What is it that brings about the tipping point from something seeming like common sense, i.e. imprisoning homosexual people, to seeming completely insane?
I think I don't think it's particularly fast. I think this is the accumulation of 20 years of changes in political attitudes, beginning with the election of the Labour government as a key moment. So I don't think it's fast at all. What I will just say very briefly is I do think it also provokes a backlash amongst the less, you know, the unreconstructed segments of the right. And part of that is in people like Trump and others who rail against these sorts of things. There's a backlash to this too.
Which is where we came in. Shashank Joshi and Daniela Pellard, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's show. It was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Jarit. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. Music next, and there's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.